The map displayed the reasons Aramilla was pressing so hard. For one, to the northeast of Camelin, almost off the map, lay the bronze image of a sleeping bear, curled up with its paws over its nose. 200,000 men, near enough, almost as many trained men as all of Andor could field. 4 borderland rulers, accompanied by perhaps a dozen Aes Sedai they tried to keep hidden, searching for Rand, their reasons unstated. Borderlanders had no cause to turn against Rand that she could see, though the simple fact was he had not bound them to him as he had other lands. But Aes Sedai were another matter, especially with their allegiance uncertain, and 12 approached a dangerous number even for him. While the 4 rulers had in part deciphered her motives for asking them into Andor, yet she had managed to mislead them concerning Rand's whereabouts. Unfortunately, the Borderlanders had belied every tale of how swiftly they could move as they crept south, and now they sat in place, trying to find a way to avoid coming near a city under siege. That was understandable, even laudable. Outland armies in close proximity to Andorran armsmen on Andorran soil would make for a touchy situation. There were always at least a few hotheads. Bloodshed and maybe war could start all too easily under those circumstances. Even so, bypassing Camelin was going to be difficult. The narrow country roads had been turned to bogs by the rains, giving hard passage to an army that large. Elaine could have wished they had marched another 20 or 30 miles toward Camelin, though. She had hoped their presence would have had a different effect by now. It might still. More importantly, certainly to Aramilla, and possibly to herself, a few leagues below the Black Towers stood a tiny silver swordsman, with his blade upright in front of him, and a silver halberdier, plainly by the same silversmith's hand, one to the west of the Black Square, the other to the east. Luon, Elorian, and Abella, Aemlyn, Arathella, and Pellavar had close to 60,000 men between them in those 2 camps. Their estates and those of the nobles tied to them must have been stripped near the bone. Those 2 camps were where Dailin had been these past 3 days, trying to learn their intentions. The spindly guardsman opened one of the doors and held it for an elderly serving woman carrying a rope-work silver tray with 2 tall golden wine pitchers and a circle of goblets made of blue seafolk porcelain. Rena must have been uncertain how many would be present. The frail woman moved slowly, careful not to tilt the heavy tray and drop anything. Elaine channeled flows of air to take the tray, then let them dissipate, unused. Implying that the woman could not do her job would only be hurtful. She was effusive in her thanks, though. The old woman smiled broadly, clearly delighted, and offered her a deep curtsy, once unburdened of the tray. Dailin arrived almost right behind the maid, an image of vigor, and shooed her out before grimacing over the contents of 1 pitcher. Elaine sighed. Doubtless it held goat's milk, and filling a goblet from the other. Plainly, Dailin had confined her freshening to washing her face and brushing her hair, golden flecked with gray, because her dark gray riding dress with a large round silver pin worked with Taravin's owl and oak on the high neck had spots of half-dried mud on the skirts. "There's something seriously amiss," she said, swirling the wine in her goblet without drinking. A frown deepened the fine lines at the corners of her eyes. "I've been in this palace more times than I can remember, and today I got lost 2. "We know about that," Elaine told her, and quickly explained what little they had puzzled out, what she intended to do. Belatedly she wove a ward against eavesdropping and was unsurprised to feel it slice through Sidar. At least whoever had been listening in would get a jolt from that. A small jolt, since so little of the power was involved that she had not sensed it. Maybe there was a way to make it a hard jolt next time, though. Maybe that would begin to discourage eavesdroppers. "So, it might happen again," Dailin said when Elaine was done. Her tone was calm, but she licked her lips and took a swallow of wine, as if her mouth was suddenly dry. Well then. If you don't know what caused it, and you don't know whether it will happen again, what are we to do?" Elaine stared. Again, someone seemed to think she had answers she did not. But then, that was what it meant to be queen. You were always expected to have an answer, to find one. That was what it meant to be Aes Sedai. We can't stop it, so we'll live with it, Dailan, and try to keep people from growing too afraid. I'll announce what happened as much as we know and have the other sisters do the same. That way people will know that Aes Sedai are aware, and that should provide some comfort. A little. They'll still be frightened, of course, but not as much as they'll be if we say nothing and it does happen again. That seemed a feeble effort to her, but surprisingly Dailan agreed without hesitation. I myself can suggest nothing else to be done. Most people think you, Aes Sedai, can handle anything. It should suffice in the circumstances. And when they realized that Aes Sedai could not handle anything, that she could not? Well, that was a river that she would cross when she reached it. Is the news good or bad? Before Dailan could answer, the door opened again. I heard that Lady Dailan had returned. You should have sent for us, Elaine. You aren't queen yet, and I dislike you keeping secrets from me. Where is Avienda? Catalin Haven, a cool-eyed, ungovernable young woman, a girl, in truth, still long months short of her majority, though her guardian had abandoned her to go her own way, was pride to her toenails, her plump chin held high. Of course, that might have been because of the large enameled pin of Haven's blue bear that decorated the high neck of her blue riding dress. She had begun showing Dailan respect and a certain wariness shortly after she started sharing a bed with her and Sergei's, but with Elaine she insisted on every perquisite of a high seat. "We all heard," Conall Northen said. Lean and tall in a red silk coat with laughing eyes and an eagle's beak of a nose, he was of age, just, a few months past his 16th name day. He swaggered and caressed the hilt of his sword much too fondly, but there seemed no harm in him, only boyishness, an unfortunate trait in a high seat. And none of us could wait to hear when Luon and the others will join us. This pair would have run the whole way. He ruffled the hair of the two younger boys with him, Perival Mantiar and Branlet Gilliard, who gave him a dark look and raked fingers through his hair to straighten it. Perival blushed. Quite short but already pretty, he was the youngest at 12, yet Branlet had only a year on him. Elaine sighed, but she could not ask them to leave. Children most of them might be, perhaps all considering Conail's behavior, yet they were the high seats of their houses, and along with Dailan, her most important allies. She did wish she knew how they had learned the purpose of Dailan's journey. That had been intended to be a secret until she knew what news Dailan brought. Another task for Rena. Gossip unchecked, the wrong gossip, could be as dangerous as spies. "Where is Avienda?" Catalin demanded. Strangely, she had become quite taken with Avienda. Fascinated might have been a better word. Of all things, she had persisted in trying to make Avienda teach her to use a spear.
"So, my lady," Conall said, strolling over to fill a blue goblet with wine. "When are they joining us?"
"The bad news is that they aren't," Dailan said calmly. "The good news is that they've each rejected an invitation to join Aramilla." She cleared her throat loudly as Branlet reached for the wine pitcher. His cheeks reddened, and he picked up the other pitcher as if he had really meant to all along. The high seat of House Gilliard, yet still a boy for all of the sword on his hip. Perival also wore a sword, one that dragged on the floor tiles and looked too big for him, but he had already taken goat's milk. Pouring her own wine, Catalin smirked at the younger boys, a superior smile that vanished when she noticed Dailan looking at her.
"That's small turnips to call good news," Birgitta said. "Burn me if it isn't. You bring back a bloody half-starved squirrel and call it a side of beef."
"Pungent, as always," Dailan said dryly. The two women glared at one another, Birgitta's hands balling into fists, Dailan fingering the dagger at her belt.
"No, arguing," Elaine said, making her voice sharp. The anger in the bond helped. At times she feared the pair might come to blows. "I won't put up with your bickering today."
"Where is Avienda?"
"Gone, Catalin."
"What else did you learn, Dailan?"
"Gone where?"
"Gone away," Elaine said calmly.
Sidar or no sidar, she wanted to slap the girl's face.
Dialin? The older woman took a sip of wine to cover breaking off her staring match with Birgitta. Coming to stand beside Elaine, she picked up the silver swordsman, turned him over, set him down again.
Aemlyn, Arathella, and Pellivar tried to convince me to announce a claim to the throne, but they were less adamant than when I spoke with them last. I believe I've almost convinced them I won't do it.
Almost? Birgitta put 100 weight of derision in the word.
Dialin ignored her pointedly. Elaine frowned at Birgitta, who shifted uncomfortably and stalked off long enough to get herself a goblet of wine.
Very satisfying. Whatever she was doing right, she hoped it continued to work.
My lady, Perival said with a bow, extending one of 2 goblets he held to Elaine. She managed a smile and a curtsy before taking the offering.
Goat's milk. Light, but she was beginning to revile the stuff.
Luan and Abella were non-committal, Dialin continued, frowning at the halberdier. They may be swaying toward you. She hardly sounded as though she believed it, however. I reminded Luan that he helped me arrest Neon and Elania back in the beginning, but that may have done no more good than it did with Pellivar.
So they may all be waiting for Aramilla to win, Birgitta said grimly. If you survive, they'll declare for you against her. If you don't, one of them will make her own claim.
Elorian has the next best right after you, doesn't she?
Dialin scowled, but she offered no denials.
And Elorian? Elaine asked quietly. She was sure she knew the answer there already. Her mother had had Elorian flogged. That had been under Ravine's influence, but few seemed to believe that. Few seemed to believe Gabriel had even been Ravine.
Dialin grimaced. The woman's head is stone. She'd announce a claim in my name if she thought it would do any good. At least she has enough sense to see it won't.
Elaine noted that she made no mention of any claims in Elorian's own name.
In any case, I left Corylus or Tophni and Julania Fote to watch them. I doubt they'll move, but if they do, we'll know straight away.
3 kinswomen who needed to form a circle to travel were watching the Borderlanders for the same reason.
No good news at all, then, no matter what face Dialin tried to put on it.
Elaine had hoped the threat of the Borderlanders would drive some of the houses to support her.
At least one reason I let them cross Andor still holds, she thought grimly.
Even if she failed to gain the throne, she had done that service for Andor. Unless whoever did take the throne bungled matters completely. She could see Aramilla doing just that. Well, Aramilla was not going to wear the rose crown, and that was that. One way or another, she had to be stopped.
So it's 6, 6, and 6, Catelyn said, frowning and thumbing the long signet ring on her left hand.
She looked thoughtful, unusual for her. Her usual style was to speak her mind with no consideration whatsoever.
Even if Candraed joins us, we are short of 10.
Was she wondering whether she had tied Haven to a hopeless cause?
Unfortunately, she had not tied her house so tightly the knots could not be undone.
I was certain Luan would join us, Conile muttered, and Abella and Pellivar.
He took a deep swallow of wine.
Once we beat Aramilla, they'll come. You mark me on it.
But what are they thinking? Branlett demanded. Are they trying to start a war with 3 sides?
His voice went from treble to bass halfway through that, and his face flushed with red. He buried his face in his goblet, but grimaced. Apparently he liked goat's milk as little as she did.
It's the Borderlanders.
Perival's voice was a boy's piping, but he sounded sure of himself.
They're holding back because whoever wins here, the Borderlanders still have to be dealt with.
He picked up the bear, hefting it as if its weight would give him answers.
What I don't understand is why they're invading us in the first place. We're so far from the Borderlands. And why haven't they marched on and attacked Camelin? They could sweep Aramilla aside, and I doubt we could keep them out as easily as we do her. So why are they here?
Smiling, Conile clapped him on the shoulder.
Now that will be a battle to see when we face the Borderlanders. Northan's eagles and Mantiar's anvil will do Andor proud that day, eh?
Perival nodded, but he did not look happy at the prospect. Conile certainly did. Elaine exchanged glances with Dailin and Birgitta, both of whom looked amazed. Elaine felt astonished herself. The other two women knew, of course, but little Perival had come near touching a secret that had to be kept. Others might puzzle out eventually that the Borderlanders had been meant to push houses into joining her, but it must not be confirmed.
Luan and the others sent to Aramilla asking for a truce until the Borderlanders were turned back, Dailin said after a moment. She asked time to consider. As near as I can calculate, it was then that she began increasing her efforts at the walls. She tells them she's still considering.
Aside from anything else, Catalan said heatedly, that shows why Aramilla doesn't deserve the throne. She puts her own ambition above Andor's safety. Luan and the others must be fools not to see it.
Not fools, Dailin replied. Just men and women who think they see the future better than they do.
What if she and Dailin were the ones who were not seeing the future clearly? Elaine wondered. To save Andor, she would have thrown her support to Dailin. Not gladly, but to save Andor's blood, she would have. Dailin would have the support of 10 houses, more than 10. Even Daneen Kandreyed might finally decide to stir herself in support of Dailin. Except that Dailin did not want to be queen. She believed that Elaine was the one to wear the rose crown. So did Elaine. But what if they were wrong? Not the first time that question had come to her, but now, staring at the map with all of its ill tidings, she could not shake free of it. That evening, after a dinner memorable only for the surprise of tiny strawberries, she sat in the large sitting room of her apartments reading. Trying to read. The leather-bound book was a history of Andor, as was most of her reading of late. It was necessary to read as many as possible to gain any real version of truth, cross-checking one against another. For one thing, a book first published during any monarch's reign never mentioned any of her missteps or those of her immediate predecessors if they were of her own house. You had to read books written while Trakand held the throne to learn of Mantiar's mistakes, and books written under Mantiar to learn of Norwellen's errors. Others' mistakes could teach her how not to make the same herself. Her mother had made that almost her first lesson. She could not concentrate, however. She often found herself staring at a page without seeing a word, thinking of her sister, or starting to say something to Avienda before remembering that she was not there. She felt very lonely, which was ridiculous. Stephanie stood in a corner against the possibility she wanted anything. 8 guardswomen were standing outside the door to the apartments, and one of them, Yurith Azeri, was an excellent conversationalist, an educated woman, though silent on her past. But none of them was Avienda. When Van Deen glided into the room, followed by Christian and Zarya, it seemed a relief. The 2 white-clad women stopped by the doorway, expressions meek. Untouched by the oath rod, pale Christian, hands folded at her waist, appeared just into her middle years. Zarya, with her tilted eyes and hooked nose, well short of them. She held something wrapped in white toweling.
"Forgive me if I'm interrupting," Van Deen began, then frowned. The white-haired Green's face somehow gave an impression of age despite her Aes Sedai features. Those could have been 20 or 40 or anything in between. That seemed to change at every blink. Perhaps it was her dark eyes, luminous and deep and pained, which had seen so much. There was an air of tiredness about her, too. Her back was straight, but she still looked weary.
"It is none of my business, of course," she said delicately. "But is there a reason you are holding so much of the power? I thought you must be weaving something very complex when I felt you in the corridor."
With a start, Elaine realized that she held nearly as much of Sayadar as she could contain safely. How had that happened? She did not recall drawing any deeper. Hastily, she released the source, regret filling her as the power drained away, and the world became ordinary again. On the instant, her mood bounced sideways.
"You aren't interrupting anything," she said peevishly, setting her book down on the table in front of her. She had not finished 3 pages of the thing anyway. May I make us private, then? Elaine gave a curt nod. It was none of the woman's bloody business how much of the power she held. She knew the protocols as well as Elaine, or better, and told Stephanie to wait in the anteroom while Van Deen wove a ward against eavesdropping. Ward or no ward, Van Deen waited until the door closed behind the maid before speaking. Rihanna Corley is dead, Elaine.
Oh, light! No!
Temper vanished into sobs, and she hastily snatched a lace-edged handkerchief from her sleeve to blot the tears suddenly streaming down her cheeks. Her cursed, shifting moods at work. Yet Rihanna surely deserved tears. She had so wanted to become a green.
How?
Burn her. She wished she could stop blubbering. There were no tears from Van Deen. Perhaps there were no more tears in her. She was smothered with the power. Whoever did it used much more than was needed. The residues of Sidar were thick on her and in the room where she was found. The murderer wanted to be sure no one would miss seeing how she died.
That makes no sense, Van Deen.
Perhaps it does. Zarya. The Saldaean woman laid her small bundle on the table and unwrapped it to reveal an articulated wooden doll. It was very old, the simple dress threadbare, the painted face flaking and missing an eye, half of its long, dark hair gone.
This belonged to Miraine Larinan, Zarya said. Deris Nirmala found it behind a cupboard.
I don't see what Miraine leaving a doll behind has to do with Rihanna's death, Elaine said, wiping her eyes.
Miraine was one of the kinswomen who had run away.
Only this, Van Deen answered. When Miraine went to the tower, she hid this doll outside because she had heard that everything she owned would be burned. After she was put out, she retrieved it and always carried it with her, always. She had a quirk, though. Wherever she stopped for a time, she hid the doll again. Do not ask me why, but she would not have run away and abandoned it.
Still dabbing at her eyes, Elaine leaned back in her chair. Her weeping had dwindled to sniffles, but her eyes still leaked tears.
So, Miraine didn't run away. She was murdered and disposed of,
a grisly way to put it.
The others, too, you think? All of them?
Van Deen nodded, and for a moment her slender shoulders slumped.
I very much fear so, she said, straightening. I expect clues were left among the things they left behind. Treasured keepsakes like this doll, a favorite piece of jewelry.
The murderer wanted us to think she was being clever at hiding her crimes, but not clever enough. Only we weren't clever enough to find those clues, so she decided to become more blatant.
To frighten the kinswoman into fleeing, Elaine muttered.
That would not cripple her, but it would throw her back on the mercies of the Windfinders, and those seemed to be growing mingy.
How many of them know of this?
All by now, I should think, Van Deen said dryly.
Zarya told Deris to keep quiet, but that woman likes the sound of her own voice.
This seems aimed at me, at helping Aramilla gain the throne, but why would a black sister have any interest in that? I can't think we have two murderers among us.
At least this settles the question of Marilla. Speak with Sumiko and Elise, Van Deen. They can make sure the rest don't panic.
Sumiko ranked next, after Rihanna, as the kin ordered their hierarchy, and while Elise stood much lower, she was a woman of great influence.
From now on, none of them is to be alone. Not ever. Always at least two together, and three or four would be better. And warn them to be careful of Kariana and Saritha.
I'd advise against that, Van Deen said quickly. They should be safe in groups, and word would reach Kariana and Saritha.
Warned against Aes Sedai? The kin would give themselves away in a minute.
Christian and Zarya nodded solemnly.
After a moment, Elaine reluctantly agreed to the continued secrecy. The kin should be safe in groups.
Let Shanella know about Rihanna and the others. I can't imagine the Windfinders are in any danger.
Losing them wouldn't hurt me the way losing the kin would, but wouldn't it be wonderful if they did decide to leave?
She did not expect that they would. Shanella feared returning to the Sea Folk with the bargain unfulfilled, yet it would be a bright spot in an otherwise miserable day if they did. At least it seemed unlikely anything could darken the day further. The thought sent a chill through her. The lights and nothing would darken it more. Aramella pushed her plate of stew away with a grimace. She'd been offered her choice of beds for the night. Arlene, her maid, was making the choice now. The woman knew what she liked. And the least she had expected was a decent meal. But the mutton was fatty, and definitely beginning to go rancid besides. There had been too much of that lately. This time the cook was going to be flogged. She was unsure which of the nobles in this camp employed him, just that he was supposed to be the best at hand. The best! But that did not matter. He would be flogged to make an example, and then sent away, of course. You could never trust a cook after he'd been punished. The mood in the tent was far from lively. Several of the nobles in the camp had hoped for invitations to dine with her, but none stood high enough. She was beginning to regret not asking one or two, even some of Nayan or Elania's people. They might have been entertaining. Her closest allies at table together, and you might have thought they sat over funeral meats. Oh, scrawny old Nason, his thinning white hair uncombed, was eating away heartily, apparently not noticing that the meat was nearly rotten, and giving her fatherly pats on the hand. She met his smiles like a dutiful daughter. The fool was wearing one of his flower-embroidered coats tonight. The thing could have passed for a woman's dressing robe. Happily, his leers were all directed down the table at Elania. The honey-haired woman flinched, her fox-like face paling whenever she glanced at him. She controlled House Sarand as if she were the high seat instead of her husband, yet she feared that Aramilla would still let Nason have his way with her. That threat was unneeded now, but it was well to have it to hand, just in case. Yes, Nason was happy enough in his futile pursuit of Elania, but the others were sunk in gloom. Their plates were abandoned, barely touched, and they kept her two serving men trotting to refill wine cups. She never liked trusting others' servants. At least the wine had not turned.
"I still say we should make a heavier push," Lear grumbled drunkenly into his cup. A whip of a man, his red coat showing the wear of armor straps, the high seat of Baron was ever eager to strike. Subtlety was simply beyond him. "My eyes and ears report more armsmen entering the city every day through these gateways."
He shook his head and muttered something under his breath.
The man actually believed those rumors of dozens of Aes Sedai in the royal palace. All these pinprick attacks do is lose men.
I agree, Carand said, fiddling with a large golden pin enameled with the running red fox of Anshar that was fastened to her bosom. She was not much less intoxicated than Lear. Her square face had a slackness about it.
We need to press home instead of throwing men away. Once we're over the walls, our advantage in numbers will pay off.
Aramilla's mouth tightened. They might at least show her the respect due a woman who was soon to be Queen of Andor, rather than disagreeing with her all the time. Unfortunately, Baron and Anshar were not bound to her so tightly as Sarand and Aron. Unlike Jared and Nayan, Lear and Carand had announced their support of her without publishing it in writing. Neither had Nason, but she had no fear of losing him. Him she had wound around her wrist for a bracelet. Forcing a smile, she made her voice jovial.
We lose mercenaries. What else are mercenaries good for if not dying in place of our armsmen?
She held up her wine cup, and a lean man in her silver-trimmed blue hastened to fill it. In fact, he was so hasty that he spilled a drop on her hand. Her scowl made him snatch a handkerchief from his pocket to blot up the drop before she could pull her hand away.
His handkerchief! The light only knew where that filthy thing had been, and he had touched her with it.
His mouth writhed with fear as he retreated, bowing and mumbling apologies.
Let him serve out the meal. He could be dismissed after.
We will need all of our armsmen when I ride against the Borderlanders. Don't you agree, Nayan?
Nayan twitched as though stuck with a pin. Slim and pale in yellow silk worked with silver patterns of Aron's triple keys on the breast, she had begun looking haggard in recent weeks, her blue eyes drawn and tired. All of her supercilious airs were quite gone.
"Of course, Aramilla," she said meekly and drained her cup.
Good. She and Delania were definitely tamed, but Aramilla liked to check now and then to make sure neither was growing a new backbone.
"If Luan and the others will not support you, what good will taking Camelin do?" Sylvaise, Nason's granddaughter and heir, spoke so seldom that the question came as a shock. Sturdy and not quite pretty, she usually had a vapid gaze, but her blue eyes appeared quite sharp at the moment. Everyone stared at her. That seemed not to faze her a bit. She toyed with a wine cup, but Aramilla thought it no more than her second.
"If we must fight the Borderlanders, why not accept Luan's truce, so Andor can field its full strength unhindered by divisions?"
Aramilla smiled. She wanted to slap the silly woman. Nason would be angered by that, however. He wanted her kept as Aramilla's guest to prevent his removal as high seat. Part of him seemed aware that his wits were gone. All of him intended holding on as high seat until he died, but he did love her.
"Elorian and some of the others will come to me yet, child," she said smoothly. Smoothness required some effort. Who did the chit think she was?
"Aemlyn, Aracella, Pelavar, they have grievances against Trakand."
Surely they would come once Elaine and Dailin were out of the way. Those two would not survive Camelin's fall.
"Once I have the city, they will be mine in any event. Three of Elaine's supporters are children, and Conail Northen is little more than a child. I trust I can convince them to publish their support of me easily enough."
And if she could not, Master Lunalt surely could. A pity if children had to be handed over to him and his cords.
"I will be queen by sunset of the day Camelin falls to me. Isn't that right, father?"
Nason laughed, spraying gobbets of half-chewed stew across the table.
"Yes, yes," he said, patting Aramilla's hand. "You listen to your aunt, Sylvaise. Do as she tells you. She'll be queen of Andor soon."
His smile faded, and an odd note entered his voice. It might almost have been pleading.
"Remember, you will be high seat of Cairn after I'm gone.
After I'm gone, you will be high seat."
"As you say, Grandfather," Sylvaise murmured, inclining her head briefly.
When she straightened, her gaze was as insipid as ever. The sharpness must have been a trick of the light. "Of course." Nason grunted and went happily back to wolfing down the stew.
"Best I've had in days. I think I'll have another plate. More wine here, man. Can't you see my cup's dry?"
The silence around the table stretched in discomfort. Nason's more open displays of senility had a way of causing that.
"I still say," Lear began finally, only to cut off as a stocky armsman with Marn's four silver moons on his chest entered the tent.
Bowing respectfully, the fellow made his way around the table and bent to whisper in Aramilla's ear.
"Master Hernville asks a word in private, my lady."
Everyone but Nason and his granddaughter pretended to concentrate on their wine, certainly not attempting to eavesdrop. He went on eating. She watched Aramilla, bland-faced. That sharpness must have been a trick of the light. "I'll be but a few moments," Aramilla said, rising. She waved a hand, indicating the food and wine.
"Enjoy yourselves until I return. Enjoy."
Lear called for more wine. Outside, she did not bother raising her skirts to keep them clear of the mud. Arlene would already have to clean them, so what did a little more mud matter? Light showed in some tents, but by and large the camp was dark beneath a half-moon. Jacob Hernville, her secretary, waited a little away from the tent in a plain coat, holding a lantern that made a yellow pool around him. He was a little man and lean, as if all the fat had been boiled from him. Discretion was bred in his bones, and she ensured his loyalty by paying him enough that only the largest bribes could be of interest, far more than anyone would offer a scrivener.
"Forgive me for interrupting your meal, my lady," he said with a bow, "but I was sure you would want to hear right away."
It was always a surprise hearing such a deep voice from such a tiny man.
They have agreed, but they want the whole amount of gold first.
Her lips compressed of their own accord. The whole amount. She had hoped to get off with paying only the first half. After all, who would dare dun her once she was queen? Draw up a letter to Mistress Andscale. I'll sign and seal it first thing in the morning. Transferring that much gold would require days. And how long to have the armsmen ready? She had never really paid attention to that sort of thing. Lear could tell her, but she hated showing weakness. Tell them a week from tomorrow to the day. That should be enough. In a week, Camelin would be hers. The throne would be hers. Aramilla, by the grace of the light, queen of Andor, defender of the realm, protector of the people, high seat of House Marn. Smiling, she went back inside to tell the others the wonderful news.
Chapter 18. News for the Dragon. Enough, Loyal, Rand said firmly, thumbing Tabak into his short-stemmed pipe from a goatskin pouch. It was Tyran leaf, with a slightly oily taste from the curing, but that was all that was to be had. Thunder rolled overhead, slow and ponderous. You'll talk me hoarse with all these questions. They were seated at a long table in one of the larger rooms in Lord Algaron's manor house, the remains of the midday meal pushed down to one end. The servants were old, for the most part, and slower moving than ever since Algaron left for the Black Tower. The rain pouring down outside seemed to be slackening, though strong gusts of wind still pelted the windows with raindrops hard enough to rattle the glass in the 6 yellow-painted casements. Many of those panes held bubbles. Some distorted what lay outside almost beyond recognition. The table and chairs were simply carved, no more elaborate than might be found in many farmhouses, and the yellow cornices beneath the high-beamed ceiling little more so. The two fireplaces, at either end of the room, were broad and tall but of plain stone, the andirons and fire tools sturdy wrought iron and simple. Lord or no, Elgarn was far from wealthy. Tucking the tabak pouch into his pocket, Rand strolled to one of the fireplaces and used small brass tongs from the mantel to lift a burning sliver of oak for lighting his pipe. He hoped no one thought that strange. He avoided channeling any more than absolutely necessary, especially if anyone else was present. The dizziness that hit him when he did was difficult to conceal. But no one had mentioned it so far. A gust of wind brought a squeaking as though tree branches had scraped across the window panes. Imagination. The nearest trees were beyond the fields, more than half a mile away. Loyal had brought down a vine-carved chair from the Ogier rooms that put his knees level with the tabletop, so he had to lean forward sharply to write in his leather-bound notebook. The volume was small for him, little enough to fit neatly into one of his capacious coat pockets, but still as large as most human books Rand had seen. Fine hair decorated Loyal's upper lip, and a patch beneath his chin. He was attempting a beard and mustaches, though with only a few weeks' growth it did not seem a very successful attempt so far.
"But you've told me almost nothing really useful,"
the Ogier rumbled, a drum booming its disappointment. His tufted ears drooped. Even so, he began wiping the steel nib of his polished wooden pen. Fatter than Rand's thumb, and long enough to seem slender, it fitted Loyal's thick fingers perfectly.
"You never mention heroics, except by somebody else. You make it all sound so every day. To hear you tell it, the fall of Ilion was as exciting as watching a weaver repair her loom. And cleansing the true source? You and Nynaeve linked? Then you sat and channeled while everybody else was off fighting Forsaken. Even Nynaeve told me more than that, and she claims to remember almost nothing."
Nynaeve, wearing all of her jeweled Tirangrial and her strange bracelet and rings Angrial, shifted in her chair in front of the other fireplace, then went back to watching Olivia. Every so often she glanced toward the windows and tugged at her thick braid, but for the most part she focused on the yellow-haired Seanchan woman. Standing beside the doorway like a guard, Olivia gave a small, brief smile of amusement. The former Damani knew Nynaeve's display was meant for her. The intensity never left her hawkish blue eyes, though. It seldom had, ever since her collar had been removed in Camelin. The two maidens squatting on their heels near her playing cat's cradle, Harlan of the Iron Mountain Tardad, and Anila of the Jaracharin, were making their own display. Shufa wrapped around their heads and black veils hanging down their chests, each had three or four spears stuck through the harness, holding her bowcase on her back, and a bullhide buckler lying on the floor. There were 50 maidens in the manor house, several of them Shido, and they all went about ready to dance the spears in a heartbeat. Perhaps with him. They seemed torn between delight at providing a guard for him again and displeasure over how long he had avoided them. As for himself, he could not look at any of them without the litany of women who had died for him, women he had killed, starting up in his head. Moraine Damodred, her above all. Her name was written inside his skull in fire. Lea of the Corsaida Charin, Sandara of the Iron Mountain Tardad, Lamella of the Smokewater Miagoma, Andalin of the Red Salt Goshin, Desora of the Musara Rain. So many names. Sometimes he woke in the middle of the night muttering that list, with Min holding him and murmuring to him as if soothing a child. He always told her he was all right and wanted to go back to sleep, yet after he closed his eyes he did not sleep until the list had been completed. Sometimes Luz Theron chanted it with him. Min looked up from the volume she had open on the table, one of Herod Fell's books. She devoured those, and used the note he had sent Rand before his murder, the one where he said she was a distraction because she was so pretty, as a bookmark. Her short blue coat, embroidered with white flowers on the sleeves and lapels, was cut to fit snugly over her bosom, where her creamy silk blouse showed a touch of cleavage, and her big dark eyes, framed by dark ringlets to her shoulders, held a pleased light. He could feel her pleasure through the bond. She liked him looking at her. Without a doubt, the bond told her how much he liked looking. Oddly enough, it said she liked looking at him, too. Pretty? He hummed, thumbing his earlobe. She was beautiful, and tied to him tighter than ever. She and Elaine and Avienda. How was he to keep them safe now? He forced himself to smile back at her around his pipe stem, unsure how well the deception was working. A touch of irritation had entered the bond from her end, though why she should become irritable whenever she thought he was worrying about her was beyond him. Light, she wanted to protect him. "Rand isn't very talkative, Loyal," she said, no longer smiling. Her low, almost musical voice held no anger, but the bond told another story. "In fact, sometimes he's about as talkative as a muscle." The look she directed at Rand made him sigh. It seemed there would be a great deal of talking once they were alone together. "I can't tell you much myself, but I'm sure Cad Swain and Varen will tell you anything you want to know. Others will, too. Ask them if you want more than yes and no and two words besides." Stout little Varen, knitting in a chair beside Nynaeve, appeared startled to hear her name mentioned. She blinked vaguely, as though wondering why it had been. Cadswain, at the far end of the table, with her sewing basket open beside her, only took her attention away from her embroidery hoop long enough to glance at Loyal. Golden ornaments swayed, dangling from the iron-gray bun atop her head. It was only that, a glance, not a frown, yet Loyal's ears twitched. Aes Sedai always impressed him, and Cadswain, more than any other.
"Oh, I will, Min, I will," he said. "But Rand is central to my book."
With no sand jar at hand, he began blowing gently on the page of his notebook to dry the ink. But Loyal being Loyal, he still talked between puffs.
"You never give enough detail, Rand. You make me drag everything out of you. Why, you never even mentioned being imprisoned in Far Madding until Min did. Never mentioned it. What did the Council of Nine say when they offered you the Laurel Crown? And when you renamed it? I can't think they liked that. What was the coronation like? Was there feasting, a festival, parades? How many Forsaken came against you at Shadar Logoth? Which ones? What did it look like at the end? What did it feel like? My book won't be very good without the details. I hope Matt and Perrin give me better answers.
He frowned, long eyebrows grazing his cheeks.
I hope they're all right.
Colors spun in Rand's head. Twin rainbows swirled in water. He knew how to suppress them now, but this time he did not try. One resolved into a brief image of Matt riding through forest at the head of a line of mounted folk. He seemed to be arguing with a small, dark woman who rode beside him, taking his hat off and peering into it, then cramming it back onto his head. That lasted only moments, then was replaced by Perrin, sitting over wine cups in a common room or tavern with a man and a woman who wore identical red coats ornately trimmed with blue and yellow. Odd garments. Perrin looked grim as death, his companions wary. Of him? They're well, he said, calmly ignoring a piercing look from Cadswain. She did not know everything, and he intended to keep it that way. Calm on the surface, content, blowing smoke rings. Inside was another matter. Where are they? He thought angrily, pushing down another appearance of the colors. That was as easy as breathing now. I need them, and they're off for a day at the Anseline Gardens. Abruptly another image was floating in his head, a man's face, and his breath caught. For the first time it came without any dizziness. For the first time he could see it clearly in the moments before it vanished. A blue-eyed man with a square chin, perhaps a few years older than himself. Or rather, he saw it clearly for the first time in a long while. It was the face of the stranger who had saved his life in Shadowlogoth when he fought Samael. Worse.
He was aware of me, Luz Theron said.
He sounded sane for a change. Sometimes he did, but the madness always returned eventually.
How can a face appearing in my mind be aware of me?
If you don't know, how do you expect me to? Rand thought. But I was aware of him as well. It had been a strange sensation, as if he were touching the other man somehow, only not physically. A residue hung on. It seemed he only had to move a hair's breadth in any direction to touch him again. I think he saw my face, too. Talking to a voice in his head no longer seemed peculiar. In truth, it had not for quite a long time. And now? Now he could see Matt and Perrin by thinking of them or hearing their names, and he had this other face coming to him unbidden. More than a face, apparently. What was holding conversations inside his own skull alongside that? But the man had been aware, and Rand of him. When our streams of balefire touched in Shadowlogoth, it must have created some sort of link between us. I can't think of any other explanation. That was the only time we ever met. He was using their so-called true power. It had to be that. I felt nothing, saw nothing except his stream of balefire. Having bits of knowledge seem his when he knew they came from Luz Theron no longer seemed odd either. He could remember the Anseline Gardens, destroyed in the War of the Shadow, as well as he did his father's farm. Knowledge drifted the other way, too. Luz Theron sometimes spoke of Emmons Field as if he had grown up there. Does that make any sense to you?
Oh, Light, why do I have this voice in my head? Luz Theron moaned. Why can I not die? Oh, Ilyena, my precious Ilyena, I want to join you.
He trailed off into weeping. He often did when he spoke of the wife he had murdered in his madness. It did not matter. Rand suppressed the sound of the man crying, pushed it down to a faint noise on the edge of hearing. He was certain that he was right. But who was the fellow? A dark friend, for sure, but not one of the Forsaken. Luz Theron knew their faces as well as he knew his own, and now Rand did too. A sudden thought made him grimace. How aware of him was the other man? Tavirin could be found by their effect on the pattern, though only the Forsaken knew how. Luz Theron certainly had never mentioned knowing. Their conversations were always brief, and the man seldom gave information willingly. And nothing had drifted across from him on the subject. At least Lanfear and Ishamael had known how, but no one had found him that way since they had died. Could this link be used in the same fashion? They could all be in danger, more danger than usual, as if the usual were not enough.
"Are you well, Rand?"
Loyal asked worriedly, screwing the leaf-engraved silver cap onto his ink jar. The glass of that was so thick it could have survived anything short of being hurled against stone, but Loyal handled it as though it were fragile. In his huge hands it looked fragile.
"I thought the cheese tasted off, but you ate a good bit of it."
"I'm fine," Rand said, but of course Nynaeve paid him no heed. She was out of her chair and gliding down the room in a flash, blue skirts swirling. Goosebumps popped out on his skin as she embraced Sayadar and stretched to lay her hands on his head. An instant later, a chill rippled through him. The woman never asked. Sometimes she behaved as if she were still the wisdom in Emmons Field and he would be heading back to the farm come morning. "You're not ill," she said in tones of relief. Spoiled food was causing all sorts of sickness among the servants, some of it serious. People would have died except for the presence of Ashaman and Aes Sedai to give healing. Reluctant to cost their lord scarce money by throwing food out, despite all the admonitions Cad Swain and Nynaeve and the other Aes Sedai gave them, they fed themselves things that should have been tossed on the midden heap. A different tingling centered briefly around the double wound in his left side. "That wound is no better," she said with a frown. She had tried healing it, succeeding no better than Flynn had. That did not sit well with her. Nynaeve took failure as a personal insult. "How can you even stand up? You must be in agony." "He ignores it," Min said flatly. Oh yes, there would be words. "It hurts no worse standing than sitting," he told Nynaeve, gently taking her hands from his head. Simple truth. So was what Min had said. He could not afford to let pain make him a prisoner. One of the twinned doors creaked open to admit a white-haired man in a worn yellow coat trimmed with red and blue that hung loosely on his bony frame. His bow was halting, a fault of his joints rather than disrespect.
"My Lord Dragon," he said in a voice nearly as creaky as the hinges, "Lord Loghain has returned."
Loghain did not wait on invitations, entering practically on the serving man's heels. A tall man with dark hair curling to his shoulders and dark for a Gildanin, women likely thought him handsome. Yet there was a streak of darkness inside him as well. He wore his black coat with the sword and the dragon on the high collar and a long-hilted sword on his hip. But he had made an addition, a round enameled pin on his shoulder showing three golden crowns in a field of blue. Had the man adopted a sigil? The old man's hairy eyebrows shot up in surprise, and he looked to Rand as if inquiring whether he wanted Loghain removed.
"The news from Andor is fair enough, I suppose," Loghain said, tucking black gauntlets behind his sword belt. He offered Rand a minimal bow, the slightest bending of his back.
"Elaine still holds Camelin, and Aramilla still holds her siege. But Elaine has the advantage, since Aramilla can't even stop food getting in, much less reinforcements. No need to scowl. I kept out of the city. Blackcoats aren't exactly welcome there in any case. The Borderlanders are still in the same place. You were wise to stay clear of them, it seems. Rumor says there are 13 Aes Sedai with them. Rumor says they're looking for you. Has Bashir gotten back yet?"
Nynaeve gave him a scowl and moved away from Rand, gripping her braid tightly. Aes Sedai bonding Ashaman was all very well in her book, but not the reverse. 13, and looking for him? He had stayed clear of the Borderlanders because Elaine did not welcome his help. Interference, she called it, and he had begun to see that she had the right of it. The Lion Throne was hers to gain, not his to give. But perhaps it was as well that he had. The Borderland rulers all had ties to the White Tower, and no doubt Elida was still eager to get her hands on him.
her and that mad proclamation about no one approaching him except through her. If she believed that would force him to come to her, she was a fool. "Thank you. That will be all, Ethan." "Lord Loghain?" he asked as the serving man bowed himself out with a last disgruntled glance at Loghain. Rand thought the man would have tried had he told him to haul Loghain out.
"The title is his by birth,"
Cadswain said without looking up from her embroidery. She would know. She had helped capture him back when he was calling himself the Dragon Reborn. He and Taim both. Her hair ornaments bobbed as she nodded to herself.
"Fah! A minor lordling with a scrap of land in the mountains, most of it all but straight up and down. But King Johannan and the Crown High Council stripped him of his lands and title after he became a false dragon."
Small spots of color appeared in Loghain's cheeks, yet his voice was cool and composed.
"They could take my estate, but they could not take away who I am."
Still seemingly intent on her embroidery needle, Cadswain laughed softly. Varen's knitting needles had stopped. She was studying Loghain, a plump sparrow, studying an insect.
Olivia had shifted her intense gaze to the man, too, and Harlan and Anila seemed to be just going through the motions of their game.
Min appeared to be reading still, but each hand rested near the opposite cuff of her coat sleeves. She kept some of her knives hidden there. None of them trusted him. Rand frowned. The man could call himself whatever he wanted, so long as he did what he was supposed to. But Cadswain prodded him, and anyone else in the black coat, nearly as much as she did Rand himself.
He was unsure how far to trust Loghain either, yet he had to work with the tools he had to hand.
"Is it done?" With Loghain here, Loyal was uncapping his ink jar again.
"More than half the Black Tower is in Arad-Daman and Ilion. I sent all the men with bonded Aes Sedai except those here, as you ordered."
Loghain walked to the table while he talked, found a blue-glazed pitcher that still held wine among the plates and scraps, and filled the green-glazed cup. There was very little silver in the house.
"You should have let me bring more men here. The numbers tilt too much to Aes Sedai for my liking."
Rand grunted.
"Since part of that is your doing, you can live with it. Others will have to as well."
"Go on."
"Dobrain and Ruark will send a soldier with a message as soon as they find anyone in charge of more than a village. The Council of Merchants claim King Al-Salam still reigns, but they wouldn't or couldn't produce him or say where he is. They seem to be at one another's throats themselves. And Bandar Ebon is more than half deserted and given over to the mob."
Loghain grimaced into his wine cup.
"Gangs of strong arms provide what little order there is, and they extort food and coin from the people they claim to protect and take whatever else they want, including women."
The bond suddenly held white-hot rage, and Nynaeve growled in her throat.
"Ruark has set about putting an end to that, but it was already turning into a battle when I left," Loghain finished.
"Strong arms won't hold out long against Aiel. If Dobrain can't find anyone in charge, then he will have to be for the time being. If Al-Salam was dead, as seemed likely, he would have to appoint a steward for the Lord Dragon in Arad-Daman. But who? It would have to be someone the Damani would accept." The other man took a long swallow of wine.
"Taim wasn't pleased at me taking so many men out of the tower and not telling him where they were going. I thought he was going to rip up your order. He tried every trick to learn where you are. Oh, he burns to know that. His eyes were practically on fire. I wouldn't put it past him to have put me to the question if I'd been fool enough to meet him without company. One thing pleased him, though, that I didn't take any of his cronies. That was plain on his face."
He smiled, a dark smile, not amused.
"There are 41 of those now, by the way. He's given over a dozen men the dragon pin in the past few days, and he has above 50 more in his special classes, most of them men recruited just lately. He's planning something, and I doubt you'll like it."
"I told you to kill him when you had the chance,"
Lúthien cackled in mad mirth.
"I told you, and now it's too late, too late."
Rand angrily expelled a stream of blue-gray smoke. Give over, he said, meaning it for both Loghain and Luz-Theron. Taim built the Black Tower till it nearly matches the White Tower for numbers, and it grows every day. If he's a dark friend the way you claim, why would he do that? Loghain met his stare levelly. Because he couldn't stop it. From what I've heard, even in the beginning, there were men who could travel who weren't his toad-eaters, and he had no excuse to do all the recruiting himself. But he's made a tower of his own, hidden inside the Black Tower, and the men in it are loyal to him, not you. He amended the deserters list and sends his apologies for an honest mistake, but you can wager all you own it was no mistake. And how loyal was Loghain? If one false dragon chafed at following the Dragon Reborn, why not another? He might think he had cause. He had been far more famous as a false dragon than Taim, more successful, gathering an army that swept out of Gil'dan and nearly reached Lugard on its way to Tyr. Half the known world had trembled at the name Loghain. Yet Mazrim Taim commanded the Black Tower, while Loghain Ablar was only another Ashaman. Min still saw an aura of glory around him. Just how that glory was to be achieved was beyond her viewing, however. He took the pipe from his mouth, and the bowl was hot against the heron branded into his palm. He must have been puffing away furiously without being aware of it. The trouble was, Taim and Loghain were lesser problems. They had to wait. The tools at hand. He made an effort to keep his voice even. Taim took their names off the list. That's the important thing. If he's showing favoritism, I'll put an end to it when I have time. But the Seanchan have to come first. And maybe Tarmon Gaiden, too. If, Loghain growled, slamming his cup down on the table so hard that it broke. Wine spread across the tabletop and dripped over the edge. Scowling, he wiped his damp hand on his coat. Do you think I'm imagining things? His tone grew more heated by the word. Or making them up? Do you think this is jealousy, Althor? Is that what you think? You listen to me, Rand began, raising his voice against a peal of thunder. I told you I expected you and your friends in black coats to be civil to me, my friends, and my guests, Cad Swain said sternly. But I've decided that must be expanded to include each other. Her head was still bent over her embroidery hoop, but she spoke as if she were shaking a finger under their noses. At least when I am present. That means if you continue squabbling, I may have to spank both of you. Harlan and Anila began laughing so hard they got the string of their game in a snarl. Nynaeve laughed too, though she tried to hide it behind her hand. Light even Min smiled. Loghain bristled, jaw tightening until Rand thought he should hear the man's teeth grating. He was trying hard not to bristle himself. Cad Swain and her bloody rules. Her conditions for becoming his advisor. She pretended that he had asked for them, and every so often she added another to her list. The rules were not precisely onerous, though their existence was, but her way of presenting them was always like a poke with a sharp stick. He opened his mouth to tell her he was finished with her rules, and with her too, if need be.
Taim very likely will have to wait on the last battle, whatever he's about, Varen said suddenly. Her knitting, a shapeless lump that might have been anything, sat in her lap. It will come soon. According to everything I've read on the subject, the signs are quite clear. Half the servants have recognized dead people in the halls, people they knew alive. It's happened often enough that they aren't frightened by it any longer. And a dozen men moving the cattle to spring pasture watched a considerable town melt into mist just a few miles to the north. Cad Swain had raised her head and was staring at the stout brown sister.
Thank you for repeating what you told us yesterday, Varen, she said dryly. Varen blinked, then took up her knitting again, frowning at it as though she too were unsure what it was going to be. Min caught Rand's eyes, shaking her head slowly, and he sighed. The bond held irritation and wariness, the last deliberate warning to him, he suspected. At times, she seemed to be able to read his mind. Well, if he needed Cadswain, and Min said he did, then he needed her. He just wished he knew what she was supposed to teach him aside from how to grind his teeth.
"Advise me, Cadswain. What do you think of my plan?"
"At last the boy asks," she murmured, setting her embroidery down beside her sewing basket. "All his schemes in motion, some I've not been made privy to, and now he asks. Very well. Your peace with the Shonshan will be unpopular."
"A truce," he broke in, "and a truce with the Dragon Reborn will last only as long as the Dragon Reborn. When I die, everyone will be free to go to war with the Shonshan again if they wish."
Min slammed her book shut and folded her arms beneath her breasts.
"Don't you talk that way," she said, red-faced with anger.
The bond also carried fear.
"The prophecies, Min," he said sadly. Not sad for himself, but for her. He wanted to protect her, her and Elaine and Avienda, but he would hurt them in the end. "I said you don't talk that way. The prophecies don't say you have to die. I'm not going to let you die, Randall Thor. Elaine and Avienda and I won't let you."
She glared at Olivia, who her viewing had said would help Rand die, and her hands slid down her arms toward her cuffs.
"Behave, Min," he said.
Her hands shot away from her cuffs, but she set her jaw, and the bond suddenly was flooded with stubbornness. Light was he going to have to worry about Min trying to kill Olivia? Not that she was likely to succeed. As well try throwing a knife at an Aes Sedai as at the Shonshan woman. But she might get herself injured. He was not sure Olivia knew any weaves but those for weapons.
"Unpopular, as I say,"
Cadswain said firmly, raising her voice. She favored Min with a brief frown before turning her attention back to Rand. Her face was smooth, composed, an Aes Sedai's face. Her dark eyes were hard, like polished black stones.
"Especially in Terraban, Amadisia, and Altara, but also elsewhere. If you agree to allow the Shonshan to keep what they've already taken, what lands will you give away next? That is how most rulers will see matters."
Rand dropped back into his chair, stretching his legs in front of him and crossing his ankles.
"It doesn't matter how unpopular it is. I went through that doorframe Tirangrial in Tyr, Cadswain.
You know about that?" Golden ornaments bobbled as she nodded impatiently.
"One of my questions for the Aelfin was, how can I win the last battle?"
"A dangerous question to pose," she said quietly, touching on the shadow as it does. "Supposedly the results can be quite unpleasant. What was the answer?"
"The north and the east must be as one. The west and the south must be as one. The two must be as one."
He blew a smoke ring, put another in the middle of it as it expanded. That was not the whole of it. He had asked how to win and survive. The last part of his answer had been, "To live, you must die." Not something he was going to bring up in front of Min anytime soon. In front of anyone except Olivia, for that matter. Now he just had to figure out how to live by dying.
"At first I thought it meant I had to conquer everywhere, but that wasn't what they said. What if it means the Shonshan hold the west and south, as you could say they already do, and there's an alliance to fight the last battle, the Shonshan with everybody else?"
"It's possible," she allowed. "But if you're going to make this truce, why are you moving what seems to be a considerable army to Arad Domann and reinforcing what is already in Ilion?"
"Because Tommen Gaiden is coming, Cadswain, and I can't fight the Shadow and the Shonshan at the same time. I'll have a truce or I'll crush them, whatever the cost. The prophecies say I have to bind the Nine Moons to me. I only understood what that meant a few days ago. As soon as Bashir returns, I'll know when and where I'm to meet the Daughter of the Nine Moons. The only question now is how do I bind her, and she'll have to answer that."
He spoke matter-of-factly, now and then blowing a smoke ring for punctuation. Reactions varied. Loyal just wrote very fast, trying to capture every word, while Harilyn and Anila went on with their game. If the spears had to be danced, they were ready. Olivia nodded fiercely, doubtless hoping it would come to crushing those who had kept her wearing Edam for 500 years. Loghain had found another wine cup and filled it with the last of what was in the pitcher, but he merely held the cup rather than drinking, his expression unreadable. Now it was Rand whom Varen studied intently, but then she had always been curious about him. But why in the light would Min feel bone-deep sadness? And Cadswain? "Stone cracks from a hard enough blow," she said, her face an Aes Sedai mask of calm. "Steel shatters. The oak fights the wind and breaks. The willow bends where it must and survives." "A willow won't win Tarmogaidin," he told her. The door creaked open again, and Ethan tottered in.
"My lord dragon, 3 Ogier have arrived. They were most pleased to learn that Master Loyal is here. One of them is his mother."
"My mother?"
Loyal squeaked, and even that sounded like a hollow wind gusting in caverns. He leaped up so fast that his chair fell over backwards, wringing his hands, ears wilting. His head swung from side to side as if he were hunting for a way out besides the door.
"What am I going to do, Rand? The other two must be Elder Hammond and Aerith. What am I going to do?"
"Mistress Kovril said she was most anxious to speak with you, Master Loyal," Ethan said in that creaky voice. "Most anxious. They are all damp from the rain, but she said they will wait for you in the Ogier sitting room upstairs."
"What am I going to do, Rand?"
"You said you want to marry Aerith," Rand said as gently as he could. Gentleness was difficult except with Min.
"But my book, my notes aren't complete, and I'll never find out what happens next. Aerith will take me back to Steading Tsofu with her."
"Fah!" Cadswain picked up her embroidery again and began working the needle delicately. She was making the ancient symbol of Aes Sedai. The dragon's fang and the flame of Tarvalin melded into a disk, black and white separated by a sinuous line.
"Go to your mother, Loyal. If she's Kovril, daughter of Ella, daughter of Sung, you don't want to keep her waiting. As I expect, you know."
Loyal seemed to take Cadswain's words as a command. He began wiping his pen nib again, capping his ink jar. But he did everything very slowly, with his ears drooping. Every so often he moaned sadly, half under his breath,
"My book."
"Well," Varen said, holding up her knitting for inspection, "I believe I have done all that I can here. I think I'll go find Tomas. The rain makes his knee ache, though he denies it even to me."
She glanced at the window.
"It does seem to be slowing." "And I think I'll go find Lan," Nynaeve said, gathering her skirts. "The company is better where he is."
That with a sharp tug on her braid and a glare divided between Olivia and Loghain.
"The wind tells me a storm is coming, Rand. And you know I don't mean rain."
"The last battle?" Rand asked. "How soon?" When it came to weather, listening to the wind could sometimes tell her when the rains would come to the hour.
"It may be, and I don't know. Just remember, a storm is coming. A terrible storm."
Overhead, thunder rolled.